Today on Against the Grain, the mass criminalization and incarceration of African Americans has received increasing attention thanks to social movements. But the role of African American leaders and the African American public in locking up Black people is much less known. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with James Forman Jr. about the confluence of forces, including class differences within the Black community, that generated African American support for punitive policies. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The mass incarceration of African Americans has been described as a new form of Jim Crow racial control. So why is it then that liberal African American leaders like Maxine Waters and Jesse Jackson, along with many others starting in the 1970s, supported policies that led to the widening incarceration of Black Americans? That question has been carefully explored in the book Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and written by James Forman Jr. Forman is professor of law at Yale University and the son of the civil rights leader. He spent 6 years as a public defender in Washington, D.C. James, let me start with a very broad question before we talk about African American leaders and the African American public. How do you understand the rise of the mass incarceration and mass criminalization of Black people in this country?
Well, I think the first thing we have to focus on, and there's been a lot of great literature on this, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which a lot of listeners will know, Bryan Stevenson's work, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and lots of academics as well who have written less public versions, have spoken about the role that racism has played in, especially in the 1960s and 1970s, when politicians who wanted to talk about race but couldn't do so publicly anymore and were able to use crime, like Goldwater and Nixon and then Reagan picking that up, and George H.W. Bush as well, were, with the infamous Willie Horton ad, were able to use crime as a way of letting voters know, hey, I still am appealing to those kind of racial instincts or racial prejudices that you have when we can't do it publicly. So I think that that was really exploited by politicians throughout, still today. I mean, Trump and Sessions are still doing it, but really, especially, it started in the 60s and 70s. And I think that also there's another way in which racism has factored into this, which is one of the ways that racism plays out is it changes our level of empathy or sympathy for somebody's suffering, right? So when there's suffering of African Americans, that doesn't register in the same way to the, in the national consciousness. And so even when people were starting to say, starting in the 1970s even, hey, this mass criminalization, this over-punitiveness has a racial dimension, that didn't matter to people, right, nationally, because we've gotten used to ignoring and underestimating Black suffering. Like, if you think about it and just step back and think, this is a country that's had slavery for longer than we haven't. And think about all the lies that you have to tell yourself about a people to justify enslaving them. That doesn't go away in national consciousness. We don't just forget the lies of Black criminality, Black ignorance, Black have a higher tolerance for pain. These are all things that we told ourselves as a nation for hundreds of years. And they become embedded in some ways in our consciousness, in our thought process. You see some of that registering in the implicit bias tests that have now become very well known. So all that is just this core part of American history, and it helps to explain why people thought it was in their interest to push for the policies that lead to mass incarceration, and also why the impact of those policies didn't register in the national consciousness.
You worked in the 1990s as a public defender in Washington, D.C., and that experience gave you a particular lens into another dynamic that you see as at play in the kind of mass criminalization, mass incarceration of African Americans in particular. I wonder if you could just talk about why Washington, D.C. actually provides that lens. What is it about the city and its history that allowed you to see mass incarceration in a different light?
Yeah, well, Washington, D.C. was called Chocolate City in the 1970s. It was 70% African American in 1971. And not only that, but it was a city that, in part because of that, attracted a political class. So a lot of the folks that were in the civil rights movement, my parents were in the civil rights movement and SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and a lot of SNCC veterans, African American, moved to D.C. because it seemed like a place where, especially after being in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and fighting that, you know, overt racism and Southern sheriffs, that Black people could have some semblance of political power and authority. And so, and D.C., although it had long been oppressed by Congress and still is oppressed by Congress, and long been denied the right to vote, got home rule, which was a semblance of local government in the early 1970s. So starting in the early 1970s, D.C. had a majority African-American city council, 11 out of 13 members. D.C. was the city, the first city in America, big city, to have a Black majority police force. D.C. has had a series of Black police chiefs until very recently, starting in the 1970s. And so it's a city where both at the level of elected officials, but also at the level of the civil service bureaucracy, right? The person you meet when you go to take a drug test down at the courthouse, the probation officer, the parole officer. These are positions that in D.C. are overwhelmingly filled by African Americans. The one group in D.C. that is still majority white in the criminal justice system are prosecutors. But even among judges, it's roughly 50-50. So it's a city that really looks like, when you just walk into the courthouse in D.C., it doesn't look like what most people think of they're going to find when they walk into a courthouse, which is now we think, you know, African-American, maybe Latino defendant, a sprinkling of Black lawyers, but everybody else is going to be white. D.C. has a very different feel.
So following the logic of the rhetoric that we hear around police brutality, it's often said that if there were more people of color, more African-Americans in the police force and other places, that the kinds of brutality and the biases against African Americans would be significantly reduced. So the logic would be in a city like Washington, D.C., since you have politicians and people all throughout the criminal justice system who are African American, that the kind of racism that has driven the criminal justice system in the country would be offset in some way. But that hasn't been the reality at all. Tell us what has been the reality there.
Well, the reality is that the criminal justice system in D.C. is just as punitive as it is in the rest of the country. So there's a lot of stories in the book, and one of the ones that I tell that really motivated me to write it involved a teenage client of mine that I had named Brandon, who was charged with possession of a gun and possession of a small amount of marijuana. And he was African American, as were almost all of my clients. And so I'm his public defender. My father's African American. My mom's white. The prosecutor, the juvenile prosecutor, is African American. The judge is African American. Everybody in the courtroom in this case was a Black person. And I was asking for Brandon to be sent home, and the prosecutor was asking him to be sent to Oak Hill, which is a dungeon, you know, a juvenile facility. And the judge had to make the decision, and he leans back and he looks in and he looks at Brandon and he says, "Son, Mr. Foreman has been telling me that you had a tough life. Well, let me tell you about tough. Let me tell you about Jim Crow." The judge knew that era, and he proceeded to lecture Brandon about what it was like. And then he said, "See, people fought, marched, and died for you to be free, son. Dr. King died for you to be free. And I tell you this, he didn't die for you to be running and gunning and thugging and carrying on and embarrassing your community, embarrassing your family." And the judge locked him up. And that kind of experience was routine for me as a public defender in D.C. and my colleagues and I in the public defender's office, who all went into the work because we saw mass incarceration as a civil rights issue of our generation, and none of us changed our views on that, right? These experiences didn't make us think we were wrong, but they did make us realize that the story was complicated, and in particular, that there were people in positions of power and authority in this system that didn't share our view, right? That didn't see this as the civil rights issue. In fact, the judge, what he did was he flipped it, and he took on, he became the Martin Luther King figure in this. And so I think when we see the incarceration rates that we have in D.C., which are equal to those in the country and in some instances exceed them, then it means that we really got to figure out whether changing the racial composition of the people in these systems is actually going to produce change, or whether this problem is more foundational, is more fundamental, is more systemic, which is what I've come to believe, which is that until we change the systems themselves, changing the racial composition isn't going to make a difference. I do believe, to be clear, and I still support more black police officers, more black prosecutors, more black judges. I support those things because I do think it's important that African Americans and all historically oppressed groups have their fair share of jobs and be able to participate in any aspect of our economy. But I don't support them because I think that their presence alone is going to change the way those systems function.
Well, let's take things back to a particular time in Washington, D.C.'s history, which, in a sense, you've evoked in talking about this judge mentioning Martin Luther King and mentioning Jim Crow and the civil rights movement as the sort of rhetoric for punishment in this case. So in the mid-1970s, when Washington, D.C., this primarily black city, was able to elect a mayor and a black city council, and you had this influx of people politically who had either gone through the civil rights movement or, you know, deeply affected by it. What happened in the mid-1970s in terms of this new elected black administration's attitude towards crime? And if you just set the stage for a moment by talking about what was happening in D.C. and in the country at large in terms of crime at the time.
Right. So the first thing that we have to be really clear on, and I think sometimes those of us that are opposed to mass incarceration, we don't like to talk about this quite as much, but it's really critical that we get this right. So homicide tripled in Washington, D.C. in the 1960s, and nationally it doubled. Addiction was tearing its way through black communities. So heroin, D.C., they tested everyone entering the D.C. jail to see if they were testing positive for heroin, and they concluded that 3% of people in 1963 were heroin addicts. By 1969, that 3% had become 45%. Now, that's truly an epidemic, and you saw that in black communities around the country in the 1960s. So now we have, crime rising. We have addiction rising. We have black people writing their elected representatives, this first group of elected representatives that we're talking about that come into power. And black citizens are saying, I'm scared. I found archives of D.C. council members who had retired and given their papers over to various libraries around D.C. And when I went through the letters that citizens had written, I was really blown away by the pain and the anguish. People saying, this is the 1970s. I can't go outside. I feel like a prisoner in my own home. I feel like a stranger on my own streets. I'm afraid to walk my child to school because there's drug dealers on the corner, and I'm afraid to leave him in the park after school because they're shooting. You have to do something. You have to stop this. Now, who's receiving these letters? This gets to, for me, the second really important part of the story. So not only is crime rising, heroin rising, people writing letters, the people that are receiving these letters are this first generation of officials who, some of them came out of the civil rights movement, some of them came out of the South. All of them remember vividly the history of under-enforcement and under-protection of the law in black communities. Today, we are very focused appropriately on over-policing and over-punishment. And so it's easy to forget that there was hundreds of years of history where the signal civil rights concern for black communities was that violence against black people never got prosecuted, never got investigated. The crime in black communities was ignored by the larger white society. So these folks all remember, you didn't call the police in a black neighborhood when there was a fight. when there was a robbery even, because the police weren't going to come. And if they did, they were just going to make matters worse. So they know that history. They remember that history. And they're bound and determined to protect those victims. When they receive that letter, they're thinking, that letter writer never got a response from government for 300 years. Now I'm in power. I'm the new elected official. I'm the new police chief. I'm the new prosecutor. I am going to respond. And so that was a real, that's why many of them have the civil rights stance that the judge has when they're talking about tough on crime, because they see it as responsive. Now, there's one more piece that's important to focus on, because then the question is, okay, but why do they respond with police and prisons and prosecution, right? That's not the, we now know that's not the only way that you could respond. They do it because they're constrained, right? So I said in the beginning that this is a story about Black elected officials and their agency in some sense. But any story in a society that is as racist as America, any story that about African-American agency is also a story about constraints on that agency. And so they're constrained by imagination, right? They can't think of a problem as anything other than a criminal justice problem. When they hear that there's addicts on the corner in front of homes, they immediately think police force, right? Because in America, we think about an addict standing out on the corner as a police or a criminal justice issue, as opposed to thinking about, well, what if we call the Department of Drug Rehabilitation Services, the Department of Mental Health? Maybe that's who we should call. So they're constrained that way. They're also constrained by politics. The people I'm writing about are local elected officials. They say over and over again, we want to invest in root causes. We want a Marshall Plan for urban America. We want better schools. We want better housing. We want better jobs. We want to end racism. They can't. We want national gun control. They say over and over again, they can't achieve that as local elected officials. They appeal to Congress, but then this is where we get to the broader story of, right, the racist structures in which they're operating. They can't get Congress to respond to their pleas. So they have what I call as an all-of-the-above strategy to fighting crime and violence. But what they get is one of the above, which is law enforcement.
That's the voice of James Forman Jr. He's professor of law at Yale and author of Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So the local government of Washington, D.C., in the mid-1970s, the city council faced a proposition that had to do with the decriminalization of drugs, of marijuana in this case. And that proposal did not get support from the Black community. It did from, I think, a significant number of whites in D.C. Tell us about that story. How it was seen through the lens of African Americans at the time. And let me just say, you make the point that that lens is not uniform. So noting that, obviously, the Black community is not one homogeneous group.
Absolutely. And that's an important point throughout. So in every chapter in this book, I have a different debate, whether it's about marijuana decriminalization or gun control or mandatory minimums or pretext policing. And in general, over the last 40 years, the bottom line is that the tough, you know, I don't want to call it tough on crime because I actually don't think it's tough, but the punitive crime warriors have won. However, they're all contested, right? And in every single chapter, I describe the opposition, because the opposition is there from the beginning. The opposition is starting to win now. Hopefully, you know, we'll get there later, but it's there from the beginning. So I think that's exactly the right point to make. Having said that, the marijuana decriminalization story I find fascinating because I come to it through the modern day lens of knowing how marijuana criminalization has had such a devastating impact on America broadly and on Black communities in particular. Right? In D.C. today, before this recent decriminalization, you were eight times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession if you were Black than if you were white. And this is a crime that we have every study that has ever been done shows that drug use is equally distributed throughout our society. So you would think, through my lens, that this first black city council in 1975, if they took up marijuana decriminalization, it would have passed. And so I was stunned when I went back and started doing the research and I found out that that didn't happen. So the person who proposed it was a guy named Dave Clark. He was a white, one of the two white members of the 13-member council. And he went to Howard Law School. He had worked with Martin Luther King. He was a progressive through and through. And he was also a civil libertarian. And those two things led him to want to support decriminalization. The opposition to his campaign came from black ministers. And it came from an African-American city council member, black nationalist named Doug Moore. What I find so fascinating about the opposition was it wasn't that they didn't care about black youth. It wasn't that they were indifferent to their suffering. Doug Moore thought of himself as a man of the people. He was actually endorsed by D.C. prisoners who endorsed somebody for the city council. They endorsed Doug Moore. He saw himself as speaking for them. But his view was that in a country as racist as the United States, when black people don't have the same access to resources, what does that mean? That means that if our kids start smoking and getting high, A, we don't have the same resources to intervene at the school if the principal finds that they've got marijuana in their backpack. We don't have the same resources to intervene with the police department if they get arrested. We don't have money to put them in a fancy drug treatment program if they become addicted, right? So he was very clear-eyed about racism, but he thought, well, that means that our children then have to be twice as good, right? This twice as good argument that has deep roots in the black community. And then we have to understand heroin. We talked about it earlier. But given how recent this heroin addiction had been, when black ministers and other people said, wait a minute, marijuana would be a gateway drug to heroin, that had real resonance. Jackie Robinson, the baseball great, his son had become a heroin addict. And Jackie Robinson was going around to black churches and black community groups in the 1970s as decriminalization was being discussed, and he said, don't do it. He said, my son, Jackie Jr., the heroin addict, he started with marijuana. It's a gateway drug. So these claims had a lot of resonance, and they ultimately persuaded a majority of the city's black residents not to support decriminalization.
And political people like Stokely Carmichael at the time also viewed drug addiction as and drug use as really destructive of radical black power.
Absolutely. So there was a whole, and that's the interesting thing about Doug Moore is he's got the minister kind of thing, but he's also got the black nationalist thing going. And yes, there was a Stokely Carmichael and a number of leaders of the black left said, we're trying to fight a revolution here. And you can't lead an army against racism if the troops are high. And, you know, Carmichael talked about drugs being a trick of the oppressor and this idea that they're allowing drugs to go into black communities as a sedative. There was a group of black nationalists in D.C. who were very opposed to methadone maintenance. The Nixon administration, which was bad in all sorts of ways, but one thing they did that was actually pretty progressive is their Office of National Drug Control Policy really wanted to invest in methadone as a response to this heroin crisis.
And methadone being a drug that allows people to come off of heroin.
Exactly, exactly. But for the black nationalists in D.C., like Hassan Jeru Ahmed, and they had their analogs all around the country, that was just substituting one drug for another. And the notion that the United States government was going to become the distributor and was going to be setting up clinics in black communities around America, giving methadone to people, they thought that that's just this is the government addicting our people. And so there was really deep opposition, and so it didn't pass.
Debates around gun violence kind of followed a similar trajectory within Washington, D.C. politics. Tell us about that, the genesis of it, and its ultimate fate.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, gun control is one of the things that I wrestle with personally the hardest, maybe in this whole book. And you can see the characters wrestling with it as well. Because So I mentioned you've got homicide tripling in D.C., you've got it doubling nationally. And one of the things that some members of the African-American political elite turned to was gun control. But you have to understand, this went up against a long history of the Black tradition of arms. So, right, almost every writer or activist who went to the South in the civil rights movement who wasn't from the South, one of the first things they were struck by is how many of the Black people in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, throughout the South had guns. And so there was this tradition that the law is not going to protect us. Not only is it not going to protect us, but the sheriffs are in cahoots with the Klans, the Klansmen. So we have to have guns to protect ourselves against white violence. So that's a centuries-long tradition. And now you get to the 1970s and you have all this street crime. And the proposal for gun control in this instance came from a number of Black elected officials in D.C. And the opposition also came from other Black elected officials. So you have this Black community kind of wrestling with, should we take these guns away from our people who have relied on them for a century against white violence? And the argument for it was Black people who are victims of crime who say, yeah, I know that the Klan was the threat in the 1940s and the 1950s. But now, today, in 1970, in an urban setting like D.C., the Klan, they haven't gone away, but they're not my principal threat. My principal threat is the guy on the street who might well be Black, who's holding me up for robbery or burglary or otherwise. And so it really flipped a lot of the traditional arguments about gun control on their head. And the city council ended up overwhelmingly 12-1 with Doug Moore, the same guy that had opposed marijuana decriminalization. He was the one guy who was standing, you know, for guns at the end of the day. But it was 12-1 for vigorous gun control. But here's the thing, and this is to me one of the tragedies of the story. They thought at the time that this was a vanguard, a precursor for national gun control. They said it over and over again. D.C. and other cities will set an example for the nation. And because they knew that as a city, they couldn't, that if they passed even a strong law with a lot of criminal penalties, that they couldn't stop guns from crossing state lines. And so they hoped and pleaded with and lobbied with Congress to do something similar. Well, we know that story, right? We know that we've just moved in the other direction nationally. So we now, in my view, in cities, have really the worst of all worlds. We have no national gun control, so guns are everywhere. We have no root cause investments. So the precursors for violence, joblessness, poverty, homelessness are all there. But we have these strict laws with strict penalties that exist mostly in our cities. So the few people that are actually going to prison today in America for possession of a gun are not the arms makers. They're not the factory owners. They're 19 and 20-year-old, mostly African-American, mostly guys like the people that I represented in D.C., like Brandon. That's who's getting locked up for possession of guns. So it's a real, in my mind, a deep tragedy, a deep example of where trying to do the right thing, they ended up, I think, adding to the problem.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with James Forman Jr. He's professor of law at Yale and author of Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. And you can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. He spent 6 years as a public defender in Washington, D.C. So we've been talking about the until now pretty hidden story of African-American support for tough-on-crime policies. And you've been talking about elected leaders in Washington, D.C. In the 1970s and beyond. But what about the African-American population of the city as distinct from the leadership? And how has, from the 1970s on to the degree that you can answer this question, how have more punitive policies been supported by some African Americans more than others? Are there distinctions you can draw in terms of class?
So it's hard to get really good data on class divisions within the Black community of the sort that we might want to before reaching generalizations. But I do, it does appear to me, and I do make the argument that part of the story here is a class story. So here's what we do know. We know that your likelihood, your risk of going to prison is dramatically higher if you're African American and haven't graduated high school versus having gone to college. It's 10 times higher for Black men who have dropped out of high school than for Black men who have gone to college. We don't have the same breakdown for women, but my experience in the court system suggests this: the disparities would be the same. And we also know that the folks that we've been talking about who are making these decisions are the college graduates. They're the elected officials, and many of them are lawyers. They've all graduated from college. And the people, like my clients that are in the book, people like Brandon, are either high school dropouts or they haven't finished high school yet if they're of that age. So we have a real difference between who's making the laws and who the laws are acting upon. And we also see this playing out in other ways, like one of the big stories I tell is the rise of African-American police forces. And there we really see a class story, because the folks starting in the 1940s, Martin Luther King Sr., the father of the great civil rights leader, was arguing for hiring Black police officers in Atlanta, Georgia. At the time, there was none. And the motto of the city was 105,000 Negroes deserve one Negro police. That was the protesters would carry those signs. And the argument that the Black elites in Atlanta made was, A, Black police officers will actually investigate crime in Black communities. The white police ignore it. And B, they said that Black police officers would be able to make distinctions among the Black community. They would be able to know who the upstanding citizens versus the disreputable ones were. So they had in their mind this vision of a police officer. They didn't explicitly talk about class, but it's clear that that's part of what was going on. Then by the 1960s, you have a new effort to try to hire Black police officers. And there, the theory isn't so much that they're going to be more aggressive, but that they'll be less likely to be brutal, right? They'll be less likely to be violent towards Black citizens. But here's the thing. During that whole history, nobody actually asked the Black police officers, the few that there were and the more that joined in the 60s and 70s. Nobody asked them. You know, Martin Luther King, his dream for his son was not that he became a police officer, right? So you have this elite group of people who are making claims about how Black police are going to change policing in America. And then you have much more working class. The most common job category for a Black officer in Washington, D.C. joining the force, when they were asked, what was your father's job? The most common answer was unskilled laborer. So this is who's choosing to join the force, because these are good jobs, and these are good jobs at a time when society is deindustrializing, right? The hollowing out of America's cities, that story that we know in the 60s and 70s, there are not a lot of jobs available. So you get a much more kind of working class group of people, many of whom weren't taking the job as police officer because they saw themselves as the next civil rights leader. They were taking the job because it was a good job. And they were going into a structure of a police department, right, that was very violent, that was very aggressive, that was really had this style of warrior policing, right, that we've had for generations. And so as Black officers and as working class Black officers who didn't have a lot of other options, it wasn't possible for them to come up with a new style of policing. So we've now had this, I think we now have this scenario where we have these hopes about how Black police are going to change America, but they haven't been reflected in actually what's happened in policing.
Going back to what you were speaking about a minute or two ago about the difference between middle class Black people, let's even say elite Black people, and working class or poor Blacks, what has that distinction wrought in terms of the kinds of politics and proposals and policies that have been put forward in terms of crime, both in terms of this period where a lot of policies were put in place? You've just been talking about some in D.C., but then more broadly with how African Americans in positions higher up have taken on the cause or not of those who are most likely to be incarcerated.
Yeah, so I think that one of the ways the class story is plays itself out is, you know, in the 1990s, we already knew, we didn't have the term mass incarceration, but the Sentencing Project had already reported that 1 in 3 African-American men was under criminal justice supervision, and they didn't have numbers for women, but I suspect they would have been similar, and or the racial disparities would have been similar anyway. And we already knew that America was 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's prisoners. But in the 90s, back when I was a public defender, you couldn't get the mainstream civil rights organizations to be involved in on the issue of mass incarceration. The first issue that became a civil rights issue that of the criminal justice system was racial profiling or driving while black. And the reason I believe that that for 15 years was really the only issue that was raised is that that's actually an issue that affects African Americans of all classes. So you don't get a pass, right? The police officer doesn't know your income, and the police officer doesn't know your education level. And that's why when you talk to, you know, black executives and others, everybody has multiple stories, dozens of stories often, of being pulled over by the police for really nothing. At the same time, things like brutal prison conditions are going undiscussed throughout America, and including mostly in Black America as well. And that's because I think that's an issue that's almost exclusively connected to the black poor. So that's where we talked before about you're 10 times more likely to go to prison if you're a black person that's dropped out of high school than having attended college. And we also know there's an economic dimension to who drops out of high school versus who goes to college. So you put those things together and you have a lot of working class and very poor folks from the most segregated, the most isolated, the most disenfranchised parts of our communities, including of our African-American communities. And they're sitting in prisons and no one's talking about them. And then you add to that, I mean, there's another aspect of the book that I only touch on, but a couple of people that I quote Calvin Rolark, one of the founders of DC's second black newspaper in circulation. And he talks about class, and he also talks about colorism. You know, he talks about in DC, he says, this is Calvin Rolark speaking. He says, we are segregated on all kinds of levels within our community. The light-skinned blacks didn't speak to the darker-skinned blacks, and the Howard University blacks didn't speak to anybody. And this is him talking in 1960s. But I do think that we just haven't been as upfront about how some of these things have affected our politics. I do think that's starting to change. I do think now that there's kind of more focus throughout Black America, right, including Black middle class, including Black elites. I mean, you have people like Cory Booker who have really made criminal justice reform a central part of the conversation. People like Ben Jealous, who's running for governor in Maryland now, who, when he was NAACP head, was really pushing this issue. So I think the story that I've been telling and that we've been talking about covering mostly 40 years is also we have to recognize, and on this dimension in particular, the class dimension and the extent to which black elites are taking up this issue, it is a story that has changed in the last few years.
Well, one interesting part of just precisely that is the story of Eric Holder, Attorney General under Barack Obama, who during his tenure, there was a sense that some of these, the criminalization policies on the federal level were being softened. Tell us about the story of Eric Holder in Washington, D.C. in the 1990s.
Yeah, so Eric Holder in a lot of ways is a sort of a paradigmatic character in my book because he becomes the U.S. Attorney in Washington, D.C. in the early 1990s. He has a long experience in D.C. He's been a judge before. And he comes into office, and he comes in at the tail end of the crack years, when homicide had already doubled and tripled again in the late 80s, early 90s. And he gives a speech on Martin Luther King's birthday in 1995. And he says to the audience, over 1,000 people, he says, we are no freer today. The black people of D.C. are no freer today than were the black people of Selma, Alabama in 1955. And what was keeping them down was segregation. And what's keeping us locked in our houses is crime and violence. Now, it's a big deal in black America when you invoke Selma. Everybody knows what you're talking about. And he did it, you know, very consciously. And then, and the audience was in agreement. Everybody knew, whether they agreed with the historical analogy or not, they knew crime and violence were too high and people were nodding. His response to that was to propose and to eventually get the police department to agree to something called Operation Ceasefire, which in D.C. meant, there's Operation Ceasefires all over the country, but in D.C. what that meant is, we are going to stop cars on any pretext of traffic violation. And the reason we're stopping the cars is not because we care about traffic enforcement. It's because we want to look in the car and we want to search the car. So, you know, an experienced officer will tell you, give me any driver 30 seconds, I'll be able to pull them over for something legally. Traffic violation, driving too fast, driving too slow, tinted windows, stopping too long at a stop sign, not stopping long enough at a stop sign, and on and on and on. So this was unleashed in D.C. The one part of the city that was explicitly excluded from Operation Ceasefire was the one majority white middle class ward of D.C. And that was on paper. And then in practice, what I've been able to pick up from my research is that some of the black middle class neighborhoods were not explicitly excluded, but they were much less heavily policed. So this most aggressive policing went in the poorest black neighborhoods, which Holder and the other people that supported this, they weren't denying. They just said those are the places where the levels of violence are the highest. So it's rational at some level. However, the impact that it had on the black community was devastating in a lot of ways. And one of the people that I write about is a client of mine, a woman named Sandra Dozier. And she was arrested one of these pretext stops. They said that her windows were too tinted. They weren't, but that wasn't the point. The point was to ask her if she had any guns. She said no. Then can we search your car? Over 90% of the people, the correct answer to that is no, but over 90% of the people don't think they can say that and do agree. And Sandra Dozier agreed. She knew she didn't have any guns. She figured she can be fine. She had $15 or $20 of marijuana in her glove box. They found it. Now, the officers were actually pretty decent. Sandra Dozier points to her FedEx uniform in the back seat and she says, please, please don't arrest me. If I'm arrested, I'll spend the night in jail and I'll miss work tomorrow and I'll get fired. She was a probationary employee on her first 3 months. They say, okay, and they give her, she has no record, they check her record, they give her a citation to appear in court a week later. She appears in court and the case is dismissed. It's no papered. So within the logic of the criminal justice system, everyone's thinking, all right, we were fair. You know, we didn't lock her up and then we dismissed the case. However, because she was a probationary employee, she had to show that she had no record. And when she went to the courthouse to get her certificate of clean record to show to her employer to get off of probation and become a full-time employee, the marijuana arrest popped up. She shows it to her employer. She thinks, well, it was dismissed. And her manager says, you're fired. And that's when I get involved because she comes to see me. And I'm on the phone pleading with the guy, it's marijuana, it's $15, it was no papered. Really, can you lose your job over this? And he says, it's not my call, you know, it's company policy. And she lost her job. And so I think one of the problems in the criminal justice system is that people don't look at down the line implications of decisions like what happened to Sandra Dozier. And if they do look at them, they don't care. We don't care enough. To me, her story and stories like it should cause everybody to stop and say, whatever we're going to do to get guns, we have to do it in a way that doesn't involve people like Sandra Dozier losing their job. But we don't do that. We say, well, you know, that's too bad, but we've got this really big crisis and onward, which is what happened in D.C.
I'm speaking with James Forman Jr., author of Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So taking things up to the present, obviously, as you mentioned, there have been all sorts of shifts in what a lot of people know anyway about the criminal justice system. There have been the rise of social movements. There have been shifts on the level of policy, and then let's just say counter shifts in terms of the Trump administration coming into power. I'm curious, what do we know about how African-American attitudes toward crime, have they changed as well?
When we look at something like marijuana decriminalization, I mentioned that in 1975, we were talking about it before, that goes before the city council and it loses. And the one opinion poll that we have done then suggested that black people, the majority of black D.C. residents, didn't support decriminalization. That same issue got picked up again in 2014, and it passed. It passed the same law that it didn't pass in 1975. And the public and the polls suggest that there was substantial majority black support for that position in the city. And I think that that shift that you can see on marijuana decriminalization is directly tied to the fact that we now we have had social movements, and we have had academics and public intellectuals writing and really documenting the devastating impact, not just to the individual, but to the community. And I think that's what shifted the conversation most in Black America, is that we now have an understanding of the community-wide impact that harsh criminal justice systems have had. And so I think that there has been a big shift. In my mind, the one place that we have yet to go as a community, and that the last chapter of my book is really devoted towards pushing towards, is breaking down this distinction between nonviolent offenders and violent offenders. I think right now, President Obama, Eric Holder, lots of the writers on this topic focus either relentlessly or exclusively on the war on drugs. And they say nonviolent drug offenders, we have to treat them with more sympathy and more mercy. But, you know, President Obama says, you know, the violent crime, violent criminals, I don't have any sympathy for them. And I think the next frontier is to kind of destroy that, obliterate that line.
Right. I mean, you point just even numerically in terms of the nonviolent drug offenders. I mean, there's been a great deal of attention focused on them. But if, let's say, drugs were decriminalized, you would still have an enormous segment of the population in jail.
Right. We'd still have the world's largest prison population, even if we released everybody in prison on any drug offense, and which I think most of those people we should release. And that would be a huge net gain to society, right? So I'm very supportive of that. It's just that I want to go further. Whenever people say violent offender, I want to remind them, first of all, robbery is the most common violent offense that we have in our prison system. And I want to say, as soon as you attach a label to somebody, then their story gets obliterated. And there's always a story.
You do mention in the book, and let me end with this, that I think it was just a couple years ago, there was a survey done of the attitudes of Americans toward crime. And I think it was something like 75%, 76% of whites said something to the effect that the criminal justice system was not hard enough on criminals. And African Americans, though fewer in number than the whites, came out in quite a strikingly large number. I think it was something like 2/3 of African Americans also endorsed the notion that the system was not tough enough on crime. How do you understand that, given that everything that's happened? And do you think that is a huge impediment in terms of thinking about some kind of thoroughgoing change that would be required to really dismantle the system of mass incarceration that we have here in this country?
Yeah, so I think I have two reactions. One, yes, I think that it does raise real obstacles. And, you know, African Americans are Americans, right? We're partially separate, but we are partially the same. And we read the same media, we consume the same media, we we read the same books, we're part of the same culture. And so there's a way in which an American, a kind of a punitive approach to criminal justice system in America is going to warp everybody's thinking. And we're part of that, right? So that's real. It's also true, I think, that surveys like that don't tell the whole story, because it's sort of like what we were talking about with Dante's case. I mean, you can say, do you want to be tougher on violent offenders? And most people are going to say yes. And you could also say, you have somebody like Dante, here's his story. What do you think we should do with him? And the Alliance for Safety and Justice and the Californians for Safety and Justice, which are great organizations, they've done national surveys of crime victims. And they've shown that if you give people a choice between prison or nothing, everybody chooses prison. But if you give people a choice between prison and drug treatment, mental health treatment, counseling, restoration, an apology, restitution, job training, right? Some of the things that were part of what Dante was being offered. If you give them a choice between that and prison, people want that. People want those alternatives by 2 and 3 to 1 margin. So I think part of the problem is that we haven't given people the right set of choices yet.
James Forman, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with James Forman Jr., professor of law at Yale. He spent 6 years as a public defender in Washington, D.C., and we've been speaking about his book, Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter @RadioAgainst.